This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Great Decisions features five speakers who focus on current political, cultural, and economic subjects that influence global affairs. In addition to tonight's lecture, next week there will be a lecture titled, Not a New Cold War, Why Russia's Aggression Requires a New Lens. Then on March 12th, the topic is human trafficking in the 21st century. And then 2 weeks after our spring break, on April 9th, we'll learn about the topic of digital privacy myths. And if you'd like more information on any of those talks, there's some flyers back in the open area behind the doors there. It's my great pleasure to welcome back to Whitworth Dr. Vandana Asthana, Professor of Government and International Affairs at Eastern Washington University. Dr. Asthana holds doctorates in both political science from Kanpur University and in natural resources and environmental science from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Her areas of research are in South Asian security with a focus on non-traditional threats and human security with special reference to water, environment, and development. Among her many publications are several books, including India's Foreign Policy and Subcontinental Politics, and Security in South Asia, Trends and Directions. Dr. Asthana has been associated with premier think tanks in the region of South Asia, like Delhi Policy Group. She is the founding member of the IC Center for Governance, New Delhi, and is currently a board member of the South Asian Studies Association. She has served as a consultant to the government of India and worked on projects with the government of Pakistan. Her most recent book, Water Security in India, Hope, Despair, and Challenges of Human Development, was published in October of last year. It should be abundantly clear that Dr. Asthana has a wealth of experience and knowledge to inform tonight's lecture, focused on the changes occurring in India today. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Asthana.
Thank you, Patrick. It is indeed a great pleasure to be here back at Whitworth, and I would like to thank the Department of Political Science at Whitworth University for inviting me to come here and speak on a topic that's currently in the news and of great relevance to the international community. I'm going to be speaking today on Modi's rise and the remaking of India. This topic, like Patrick mentioned, falls under the theme of the Great Decision series, which was India Changes Course. 2014 was the year of parliamentary elections in India, and we saw that the people of India and the electorate of India seemed to be upset, discontented, frustrated with the political system and the UPA coalition government that was leading India for the last two terms. There were several issues that faced the Indian society. First, of course, was because of a coalition, there was a complete policy paralysis in the government. They also saw the rise of daily commodities skyrocketing. For example, onion is a very common staple thing that's used in Indian curries and Indian cooking, and the price of that really skyrocketed. Apart from that, the legitimacy of the government was also in question because of the scams, corruption scandals, and a lot of black money that was being talked about and raised by the opposition in the parliament. India seemed to be at a point where it was looking for some kind of a change. And 2014 parliamentary elections were a kind of a historical election in the history of India for several reasons. One, of course, India was under a polarized polity for the last 35 years. For the last 35 years, we had not seen any government with the full majority in the parliament. Second was we saw 551 million voters vote for 543 constituencies, which is the current total membership of the lower house of the parliament from where the government is elected and from where the government runs. It was also historical in the sense, for the first time in the history of general elections in India, there was a voter turnout of more than 66%. The BJP, also known as the Bharatiya Janata Party, came to power with a full majority, having 283 votes in the 543-member Lok Sabha. Along with its allies, it totals to around 336 votes in the parliament. The prime ministerial candidate for BJP was Prime Minister, the current Prime Minister, Narendra Damodar Modi. I'll mention Modi, that's easier to kind of talk about as I go into the speech. And Modi was then the Chief Minister of Gujarat. As he was announced the prime ministerial candidate, he stepped up the rhetoric of development. And his ability to inspire the perception that Modi means change led the people in India to speculate, and countries across the world to speculate whether Modi really meant change. Modi, to give you a brief overview of him, he was born in a small town called Vadinagar in the state of Gujarat. And he comes from a humble background. His father was a tea vendor, and he used to sell tea with his father at the railway station in Vadinagar. As he went to school, he did not seem interested in studies. He was not a very good student, and he was often termed, or has been often termed by his biographers, as unsociable and even at times revolutionary. At the age of 10, he went ahead and joined an organization called the RSS. The full form of RSS is Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh. The translation for that is National Volunteers Organization. It is a right-wing Hindu nationalist organization with a full-fledged agenda of Hindutva or Hindu nationalism. This organization has been banned in India from time to time. Mahatma Gandhi's assassin was actually from this organization, and it has a very strong Hindu nationalist approach towards the country as a whole. He was given the task of being an activist in promoting the views of the RSS, and he worked for several years in the RSS before he was assigned another task to the political wing of the RSS, which is the BJP. BJP is also a parliamentary, it's a national party known as the Bharatiya Janata Party, and it is also the political arm or the political wing of the RSS. It is also steeped in strong nationalism, but whenever it has come to power, win a coalition, it has always kind of emancipated itself from the strong right-wing Hindu nationalism, although most of the political leaders are steeped in that ideology of the right-wing Hindu nationalism. So Modi was assigned the task of working for the political wing, the BJP, the current party in power, and he worked in it for several years until in 2001 he was made Chief Minister of Gujarat, a small state on the western borders of India, where he started to run the government. Modi has been known for a no-nonsense kind of an administration, and he's also known for his pro-business and pro-liberal policies. When Modi became the chief minister, it has been argued by a lot of economists that he changed the face of Gujarat. Gujarat became a very prosperous state. Growth ran in double digits. He does the big, vibrant Gujarat summit, where he invites a large Indian diaspora into the country, into the state, along with other foreign investors, giving them incentives and tax breaks to come and invest in the country. People do debate his role in the prosperity of Gujarat, but nonetheless, Gujarat was a prosperous state and is still a prosperous state. One of the major controversies that he was known for was the Godhra riots. And Godhra is a small town, a predominantly Muslim town in the state of Gujarat, where he was the chief minister. A train that was carrying 59 Hindu pilgrims from a pilgrimage was actually stopped at that particular town, and the compartment that had the pilgrims was actually set to fire. So 59 Hindu pilgrims actually were burnt alive to death, and that had a backlash amongst the Hindus in Gujarat, which led to a huge amount of communal riots, killing more than 1,000 Muslims, as well as displacing several thousand. Modi was considered liable because he was a chief minister, and it was argued that his administration was inactive. Although the Supreme Court of India, has absolved him of any direct linkages to the Godhra riots, yet there's a sense in the society that these things, the riots could have been avoided if Modi's administration had acted in time. Modi was the chief minister of Gujarat for four terms, from 2001 to 2012. This was his fourth term before he was announced as a prime ministerial candidate by the BJP. As he became the prime ministerial candidate, he tried to emancipate himself from the RSS ideology and started focusing on development and not identity politics. Modi has an extraordinary charm. He has a charismatic personality. His electrifying demeanor tends to attract people. He's a great orator. He speaks extempore and draws, people in towards him. Therefore, people were kind of drawn by this rhetoric of development that he talked about, and he presented himself as a leader who had an articulate vision, a pragmatic approach, and he was going to definitely take India to new growths and to new heights. For the people of India were actually looking forward towards a leader in whom they could invest their hopes and the capacity to set things right. And that was where Modi actually was looked at as a game changer. When Modi became the prime minister, a lot of people said, it's change, corruption is going to go, bureaucracy is going to be streamlined, there'll be a lot of opportunities for development, especially because India is at a point of time where 67% of India's population is under 35. There's a huge youth bulge that is looking for new avenues and new opportunities. And so Modi's development rhetoric actually eclipsed the communal riots that he is so much known for in the international as well as in the Indian community. Once Modi became the prime minister, he actually went ahead and made some key policy decisions as far as the domestic government was concerned. Since his electoral mandate was development, change, economic growth, prosperity, he really had to show the population that he wanted to stand, at least he had that intent to work towards those goals. Some of the key policy pronouncements that he made and that he's been known for as his grand visionary ideas relate to creating a digital India by 2019. I would argue, yes, they are definitely ambitious reforms that he's looking for, but there is a credibility also in these ideas. And one of his major goals is to emphasize communications. Modi has this element of surprise, and although he looks like a commoner, he has been using the social media to the best of his advantage, whether it's Facebook, it's Twitter. He's even started a radio program where he connects with the people on the ground, and people every Sunday sit by the radio. That's kind of obsolete these days to kind of listen to what he has to say. So Digital India is one of his key goals. He wants to ensure that there is internet access in all parts of India, in the villages of India. The rural people can connect with the government through the digital access. That is one of his key policy pronouncements that he wants to get done by 2019. He has already allocated a few hundred crores for that, but it is still an ambitious project. The second important policy pronouncement that he made as part of his grand vision to lead India to new heights was called Clean India by 2019. Although Modi is kind of considered a pro-business, a pro-liberal, a pro-capitalist administrator, with this element of surprise, he started this program or project called Swachh India or Clean India. He started this project with great conviction and vigor. He took a broom in his hand. He went to a Dalit outcast colony where he swept the streets of that colony and engaged with a lot of other celebrities and challenged them to keep the movement going. The movement is on, but again, it is a challenging, ambitious program, not necessarily because of the cultural ideas and our lack of education towards sanitation and cleanliness, but also towards river pollution and industrialization that also kind of adds to some of these problems. He started this program on Mahatma Gandhi's birthday on October 2nd, 2019, and he plans to complete it on his 150th birth anniversary on October 2nd. He started it in 2014, and he plans to complete it in 2019. The third important domestic policy pronouncement that he made was the creation of 100 smart cities. One wonders, what is a smart city? Smart cities are, in his vision, urban centers that are technologically sound, environmental friendly, business oriented, working on green technologies, and have all the communication available to them. He wants to create these kind of spaces in different parts of India where he envisions a larger, prosperous India taking shape. He's already pulled in a lot of investors for these smart cities. For example, the United States is committed to developing the city in the south called Visakhapatnam. China, again, has committed itself to developing a city in the state called Uttar Pradesh, called Allahabad. Japan is committed to, again, developing a city called Varanasi, from where he actually won the mandate as the prime ministerial candidate. So he's already started work on it, and he's looking for investment to help create these smart cities. Other than that, Modi had another element of surprise. In contrast to his pro-business policy, he created a program which is actually the Jan Dhan Yojana. It's a program for people who do not have access to the financial system. Through this program, he ensured that anyone and everyone could open a bank account. There are still lots of people in India who do not have access to bank accounts because of banking procedures that make it difficult for people to go ahead and deposit money or make use of the bank. He ensured that anyone who wanted could come to the bank, open an account, and that actually had a lot of benefit in terms of the money flow that actually got into the banks after he announced the program. There are still people in rural India that like to keep money at home, and this kind of advantage, when offered to them, was used up by them, and a lot of money flew into the banks, which also could be used for other developmental purposes. At the same time, people also felt engaged with the system. The people were also given opportunities for taking a loan from the bank, even if they did not have enough money in the bank. And the only concern that critics have about that is how long and will the poor or will the people actually use the system to the extent that Modi visualizes. One more important element of Modi's governance was that India is a quasi-federal state, so we have a center and we have states, pretty much similar to the United States system of governance, except that we have one constitution, and in normal times, India is a federal state, but in times of emergency, India becomes a unitary state. There has been a lot of protests from the states in India that they lack the power to take decisions. They are forced upon by the central government to take up projects that may not necessarily trickle down to the societies and the constituencies that they represent. Modi made a big change as far as the dismantling of the Planning Commission was concerned. The Planning Commission originated in the Nehru socialist era, when Prime Minister Nehru, India's first prime minister, actually borrowed this plan or borrowed this program from the then USSR. Modi decided to dismantle this program, create a new body called the Policy Commission, whereby he has given representation to states. He's taking the information provided by the states, and he's also said that he will give a greater share to the states in terms of taxes that come to the center, but earlier were granted to the states based on the Planning Commission's analysis of that. That shows a great departure from earlier prime ministers and earlier forms of government in trying to engage the state and also taking in the recommendations of earlier commissions that have argued for more financial autonomy of the states as well as more power to the states. But the last and the most important policy pronouncement that he made on the domestic front was called the Make in India campaign. The Make in India campaign is an international marketing strategy conceptualized and conceived by Prime Minister Modi to make India the manufacturing hub of the world. Not only make India the manufacturing hub of the world, but also invite foreign direct investment in the country, which would be beneficial not only to the investors, but also for the growth and development of his economy. This is his grand narrative on which he bases development and growth prospects of India. The purpose of this campaign is to invite heavy industries and public sector undertakings. It is also to do away with tedious regulatory bureaucratic provisions that had frustrated US and other businesses for investing in India. And it's also to develop the secondary and the tertiary sector of India, and at the same time, ensure that retail and local competition does not happen and those sectors are kind of secure. This is one of his grand visions as far as Modi's domestic policy and goal towards making India visible in the global economy is concerned. These are some of the major policy pronouncements he did at the domestic level, some of which were definitely a key shift and a departure from earlier administrations and earlier governments in power. The challenge also could be that this is the first time in 35 years a government has a great majority in the parliament. All of these pronouncements have been recently made in the form of ordinances by the prime minister, by the president. These have to be passed by the parliament, and this is something that we'll have to watch for to ensure whether these policy pronouncements actually take the shape of a legislation. On an international front, Modi took certain initiatives that could be considered the first in terms of the earlier administrations and the earlier forms of government. I want to just talk about three major initiatives. The first, the neighbors first policy. The second, the Act East Asia policy. And the third, working towards an enduring Indo-US partnership. In most cases, when you look at countries, foreign policies tend to be a continuation of earlier governments. Even in India, it's pretty similar. The policy is continuation of the earlier government. What is different is the style and implementation of that policy. Then that's where Modi becomes a key actor in trying to change or implement that. Modi's neighbor's first policy was when he became prime minister, he has been the only prime minister to have invited all the heads of states to his swearing-in ceremony. All the heads of state did comply, including Pakistan and including the South Asian neighbors. And what he wanted to reassure these neighbors was that don't go by the size of India. India is still willing to engage with you on mutually beneficial terms. In the past, what we've seen is most of these neighbors, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Nepal, except for Bhutan and Pakistan, have actually engaged with extra regional powers like the United States or have engaged with China to try and counterbalance the security dilemma that these countries tend to face with India. Prime Minister's first step by engaging them was considered an important part of his foreign policy initiative, although I would still argue that India and its neighbors have certain border policy issues that still need to be resolved, especially in terms of Pakistan, as far as China is concerned, a porous border between Bangladesh as such. But his effort, again, is to revive the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation. He believes that regional stability is important, and he needs to engage the neighbors that are relevant to ensure that India can also play an assertive, yet a harmonious role in the region, which is called South Asia. His second important change was look east to act east. As we look at this map right here, we can see a brief glimpse of Asia in general. In 1992 to 1996, the governments in charge actually created a policy which was called the Look East Policy. One of the reasons for that was that India had liberalized, India was looking for markets, India was also looking for trade. And so the Look East Policy was one of the key arguments that earlier Indian governments had made. But what Modi felt was, Modi did a lot of robust and bilateral visits and thinking as far as Asia was concerned, and he believed that the Look East Asia policy was limited and it had been inconsistent. So his narrative changed from Look East policy to Act East Asia policy. And one of the first things that he did when he became prime minister was that he went to Japan. He met with Prime Minister Abe. He calls Prime Minister Abe his old friend because Prime Minister Abe has invested a lot in Gujarat and has been part of the Gujarat summits. And they signed a joint declaration which was about economic cooperation, infrastructure building, manufacturing, but also maritime exercises as well as defense and security. On the other hand, we also saw the Prime Minister of China, who visited India also to invest in India about $30 billion. Japan is investing $35 billion. China came in an agreement was signed and a joint statement was issued with China. But what is also interesting is that while the Chinese Prime Minister was engaging and signing a joint declaration with India, Chinese military was doing incursions in the border disputed area of India. And so what we saw was that India was definitely upset on that and it protested against that. China is definitely playing a major and assertive role in Asia. So the Prime Minister also went ahead and met with the ASEAN countries right here. These are 10 major countries with 10 dialogue partners to engage with them on issues of maritime security, defense, and regional stability, because China has been playing a very assertive role in this region, which definitely alarms India. He was also the Prime Minister to visit Australia after 1986. The last visit of the Indian Prime Minister was 1986. And so 1986 to 2015, there was no prime ministerial visit to Australia. He went ahead and signed a joint statement with Australia. They completed a civil nuclear deal whereby Australia will be providing uranium to India for its nuclear power plants. And so what we're seeing is that Modi's ACT Asia policy was aggressive, was assertive, and Modi not only wanted to build trade relations with these countries. Currently, the trade is $68 billion. They want to move it to $100 billion in 2015. But it was just not about trade, but it's also about regional security, regional stability, and maritime security. What was also interesting in the joint declarations between Japan and China was that when China's joint declaration strongly focused on economic growth, Japan's joint declaration focused on defense and security and economic growth. And so what we're seeing is that there's a sense of a regional security network that Modi wants to emphasize as far as his ACT East Asia policy is concerned. The third and the last that I want to talk about is an enduring Indo-US partnership. Here in the United States and in India, there's been a huge hype about Obama as well as Prime Minister Modi's relationship. There have been two visits, formal visits, first by Prime Minister Obama, Prime Minister Modi, and the second by President Obama, and as the media has really played that out in a big way. But the question of an enduring partnership also needs to be understood in the historical context of Indo-US relationship. Through these visuals that I have right here, I want to just give you a brief overview of how India and the United States have used each other in the past several decades. If you look at the period from 1950s, India's policy of non-alignment or the move towards non-alignment was actually viewed with skepticism by the United States. The Cold War was going on, there was this baggage of containment of communism in Asia, and in the 1950s, while India was signing the principles of non-alignment at the Bandung Conference, Pakistan was actually becoming a part of the United States alliances to contain communism in Asia. The Southeast Asian Treaty Organization and the Central Treaty Organizations were some of the military alliances that Pakistan was a part of. The underlying assumption was that it was not necessarily about containment of communism, but it was more about bringing in arms and armaments to deal with the India Pakistan problem of the Kashmir and the Kashmir state. The 60s actually saw the United States support India in the Indo-Chinese War. Again, it goes back to the Cold War politics where communism was again a key issue, and so India was supported by United States totally in the Indo-China War, where India actually lost a lot of territory. 14,500 square miles of territory is still with China, and in terms of the disputed state, Chinese military actually captured it, but then suddenly decided to go back to the ceasefire line, and so the area is still called disputed. The 70s saw a dip in Indo-US relations. We had the Indo-Bangladesh War. Pakistan was partitioned into two states, And while India was trying to impress upon the United States that it was the migration problem and also the discrimination of the West towards the East, the United States still leaned towards Pakistan, and it supported in an implicit way the Pakistan in the 1971 war, and also marginalized and avoided the Islamic bomb that was coming up in a big way during that period. It was in the 1990s that was also a really low ebb in Indo-US relationships. And the BJP coalition was in power at that time, and India made a nuclear explosion in Pokhran 5 test without informing the international community. Since the international community was not necessarily informed, the international community, including the United States, protested, condemned it, and even imposed sanctions against India, which continued until 2001 and were removed when the Bush administration came into power. In 2000, President Clinton actually visited India. The idea was that we are democracies, but we are estranged democracies, and therefore we should work together to engage and play an important role in the global community. The last and the lowest ebb before Modi came into power was in December of 2013. An Indian Deputy Consul General was handcuffed, taken to jail, strip searched by law enforcement officers on grounds of visa fraud and underpaying her household help. That created a huge uproar in India. India threatened to remove the security that India offered to the US Embassy in Delhi. India took away the diplomatic ID cards of the families of the diplomats stationed there. But later on, the lady was repatriated, and the problem seemed to be resolved. So when we look at the period of 1950s to 2000, we see huge lows and highs. In the period of 2000 to 2012, we did see a period of highs when President Bush visited India and signed major deals with India. President Bush actually gave India an opportunity to play a global role and a more active role in global politics by going ahead and emphasizing that India was a responsible nuclear power, even though it had not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and went ahead and signed the civil nuclear deal. India at that time didn't seem to be ready for that. India still was on the fence as far as non-alignment was concerned and did not take that opportunity, which has been, analyzed, taken in by Prime Minister Modi. We did see that there were several agreements with the United States during the Bush administration, the civil nuclear agreement being the key of all those agreements, but the agreement was stalled for a parliamentary law passed by the Indian Parliament, which talked about liability issues that kind of restrained American companies like GE and Westinghouse to go into India to build civil nuclear plants. I guess one of the reasons was that India has been victim to a major gas tragedy in 1984, and keeping that in mind, the liability law was passed by the Indian Parliament, and US has a lot of concerns about that. The US also lost a major defense deal during that period with India. And the major point of contention was United States leaning towards Pakistan, recognizing Pakistan as a non-NATO ally, providing Pakistan F-16s. These were some of the key issues, apart from the fact that the liability law did not allow the civil nuclear deal go forward. After the incident of the Deputy Consul General occurred, a few months later, the United States was in a predicament. Prime Minister Modi was the prime ministerial candidate, and the question was, how should United States interact with Modi? Has the United States ever interacted with Modi before? United States interaction with Modi was limited to the condemnation of the 2002 communal riots. That's where the interaction began, because he was the chief minister of Gujarat and he wasn't really a national figure. Second, Modi decided that he wanted to come to the United States in 2005. The United States denied Modi a visa till he became the prime minister in 2014. So the visa was denied on the basis of a Freedom of Religion Act passed by the United States Congress that allows the United States to prohibit any leader, political leader, from visiting the country if it does not have concern for its minorities. Under that clause, Modi tried hard in 2012 too, but he was denied a visa. However, as Modi became the prime ministerial candidate in September of 2013, United States decided to end its 9-year boycott of Modi. United States actually sent Nancy Powell to Modi to meet Modi at his capital in Gandhinagar at his residence. And in 2014, when Modi was declared the prime minister, President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry were among the first few to congratulate Modi and invite him to Washington, D.C. President Obama actually said that they would like to work with the Indian leadership that has been elected by the Indian people. Modi accepted this visit. And the acceptance of this visit emphasizes two important qualities of Modi. First, that he does not keep personal rivalries and emphasizes more on national interests. Or if he did have personal rivalries, he kept that aside and he looked at national interest as a prime objective, being the prime minister. The second important quality that we thought that could be attributed to Modi was Modi's recognition that United States is a key actor and a key player in fulfilling the grand ambitious agenda of development and growth that Modi had declared as his electoral mandate. So, in other words, Modi accepted the visit, Modi went to the United States, and in a way, Modi actually forced India back on Obama's agenda. One could argue that in the past few years, Obama administration was busy with the Middle East, Afghanistan, and it could also be thought that this withdrawal from Afghanistan could have also provided the space to President Obama to kind of engage with India on a bigger scale. And so, there was this, skepticism that when Prime Minister Modi visited President Obama, there was this skepticism because there was this huge media hype that they were natural allies, they were friends, and so one wondered that an RSS activist and a law professor, could they be natural allies? Or was it about strategic priorities and a genuine reassessment of the prime minister made by the U.S. administration? International politics, a lot of time, events are circumstantial, events are exogenous, but there's one important thing, that while national interests matter, strategic priorities are important, leadership also matters. And so when we look at this relationship, there was a convergence of interests between President Obama and Prime Minister Modi. There seemed to be a geopolitical alignment of interests that I guess brought the two together, which could also be included in the bromance that's been talked about. If you look at this little cartoon here, it talks about how the two decide to engage with each other, and it's U.S. priorities and India's priorities, and the leadership that talks about those priorities. And the geopolitical alignment and convergence of interests were related to the U.S. pivot to Asia policy. The United States has been concerned over a period of time, again and again, over China's growing presence in Asia, China's assertive role in Asia, China's desire to be a hegemon in Asia, and that's US's pivot to balance policy, which kind of ties in with India's own Act East policy, because India also has been concerned of China's assertive role in the region. On the other hand, we have this idea about doing business with India, as well as Modi's ambitious development agenda. So we kind of see that these geopolitical and economic interests seem to combine. And what was also recognized amongst the two leaders was that a strong and democratic India in Asia and the global world is good for the United States, while an influence of the United States in Asia and the United States as a big player is also good for India. With those ideas in mind, the two leaders tended to converge as far as their priorities were concerned. When Modi came back from Washington, D.C., he took a very bold step. He decided to invite President Obama to India on the 26th of January, which is also called the Republic Day of India. 26th January 1950, the Indian Constitution was promulgated, and since then, that day has been celebrated in India as a celebration of India's constitutional democracy, as a celebration of India's diversity, and a celebration of showcasing India as a rising military power. In most cases, you know, summits between two leaders so closely are rare. But Modi decided to invite Prime Minister President Obama to India for the Republic Day ceremony as the chief guest. And the White House responded equally that the President Obama accepts that request. And if we look at this visit that President Obama made to India on 26th for the 26th January celebration parade, a lot of people think it marks a watershed in Indo-US relationships. And this visit can be understood from three lenses that I want to talk about. And the first, of course, is the symbolic lens. The second is the political lens. And the third is the pragmatic lens. From a symbolic perspective, both countries are democracies. Inviting President Obama for the Republican Day parade was also considered a strategic decision by Prime Minister Modi. Although he's a lame duck president at this point of time, he still has great foreign policy powers. Modi also realized that it will be a long wait till 2016 before he can think of inviting another president to India. So the acceptance of that and Prime Minister Modi's invitation showed that both these countries wanted to send a message to the world. Both these countries also wanted to emphasize the democracy and the diversity that these two countries kind of represent. And so, what is also important about the Republic Day Parade is that the chief guest of the Republic Day Parade is generally reserved for key United States allies and key Indian allies. And there were people like President Putin, who's been the guest before, and Prime Minister Abe of Japan, who's been the guest before. And so that also kind of emphasized the symbolic message that we are looking for an enduring partnership with the United States. The Prime Minister actually broke protocol to greet President Modi. Here's a picture where Prime Minister breaks protocol and he goes to where President Obama is coming out of the airplane and kind of goes ahead and greets them. Never in the history have we seen, leaders addressing each other by first name in press conferences, and we saw Modi address President Obama as Barack in the press conference. And those were the kind of symbolic messages that they wanted to give to the world of moving towards an enduring partnership. The other point that is important from this visit, which is called a watershed in Indo-US relationships, is the political lens. Prime Minister Modi recognizes the domestic political value of a closer relationship of India with the United States rather than an equidistant value. The Pew Research Center did a study, and more than 80% of young Indians hold a very favorable opinion of the United States. And therefore, he wanted to capitalize on that. And at the same time, he also wanted to think about the Indian diaspora that is in the United States, which is extremely wealthy, professional, and has been part of the Obama administration and have been in key positions also in the Obama administration. So he recognized that domestic political value. He also recognizes the Indian diaspora and the value that it attaches to the Obama administration as well as to India, and he wanted to capitalize on that. The second important thing that he wanted to talk about was both saw each other as crucial in offsetting China's assertive role in Asia. Prime Minister Modi, for the first time, went ahead and even mentioned a regional security partnership, which none of the prime ministers have ever thought of before, because India has been sitting on the fence on the policy of non-alignment, has been hesitant to, even though there have been areas, gray areas, where it has been criticized for leaning on one side or the other, it has been hesitant to kind of go ahead and openly mention a regional security partnership with the United States, Japan, Australia, and India. And I guess Modi does not carry that kind of baggage that the Indian National Congress was carrying. And therefore, he has not been hesitant to make those steps that he feels is necessary for India's assertive role in the region and in the globe. And one of the reasons why India has been alarmed and the United States been alarmed is the Maritime Silk Route proposal of 2013. If you look at these red dots right here, this was a proposal made by China. China has been visiting all of these smaller states in ASEAN and in South Asia and plans to build ports and infrastructure development for these countries to engage in maritime trade. That was really alarming for India, who thinks that India has even earlier historical ties to this region, and therefore India reacted with its own proposal, which is called the Project Mausam. Mausam in Hindi means weather, and in ancient India, trade was conducted with these areas through wind patterns. So as the wind went one way, ships sailed this side. As the wind went the other way, ships sailed that side. And so the Indian government has started its own project, again, in a perspective of counterbalancing China's Maritime Silk Project. The reason for that also was because a lot of the smaller states seemed that it was a good project and were willing to support China in that project. So in that connection, we see this project weather, and there's a huge emphasis on cultural heritage as well as trade ties between India and these countries. The pragmatic lens is tied to the domestic agenda of Prime Minister Modi, but is also tied to the domestic agenda of President Obama. There has always been a very strong lobby in the United States that feels that India is a huge market and doing business in India will be productive, not only for India, but also for the United States. And from a pragmatic lens, the Make in India campaign was one area where Prime Minister Modi wanted U.S. investment, U.S. businesses, and he, when he came here at Madison Square, we addressed a gathering of 20,000 people, the largest that any political leader has addressed here. He tried to reassure the business community as well as the Indian diaspora that he's going to go back and make those changes so that the ease of business will allow these people to come in and invest in India. From a pragmatic lens, because he talks about Make in India campaign and he wants to make India a manufacturing hub and invite foreign direct investment, he also looks at joint production, co-production and co-development in the defense sector, whereby he's looking at raising the FDI to allow foreign companies and corporations from the United States into India. But the emphasis, again, is on heavy industries and areas where the local industries and the local competition could be protected, or they could be part of the secondary and the tertiary sector of these bigger industries. And then, of course, the civil nuclear deal was considered to be one of the biggest successes of the Obama and Modi dialogue. They came to a conclusion about the liability law. The liability law is passed by the parliament, cannot be revoked until another law comes into place. So they decided to create an insurance pool, and that insurance pool would actually be the pool if in the case of accident was from where the money could come from for the people if and when the need arose. And that was considered a huge breakthrough as far as India-US relationships was concerned. And when he did come back, he has been making an effort to reduce these legislative and bureaucratic challenges that in American businesses and European businesses face in India. One of the key things that he is currently fighting in India is for the land acquisition law, which is being protested not only by the farmers, but also by the global civil society of a vibrant democracy like India. And so the question, therefore, is what kind of a partnership do we look at? So I could just go back further down. There are benefits for both India and the United States, but the challenge is, can we keep this partnership going? Given the history of Indo-US relationships, is it really about bonhomie? It's really about bromance? That's a key question. And so, although we see those kind of benefits that we've actually talked about in terms of the partnership, there is also a concern on areas like these. Will India be a permanent ally? Is India following a policy of permanent alignment, or is India following a policy of multi-alignment? To a lot of people, it looks like India is following a policy of multi-alignment. There is a conceptual ambiguity as far as the word strategic is concerned in their relationship. How do both countries view a strategic partnership? As far as climate change is concerned, were India and the United States, or both heads of states, were they able to come to an agreement? India was unable to come to an agreement similar to which President Obama had signed in China when he last visited about limiting greenhouse gases emissions. India feels it's really behind China and is in no position at this point of time to cut down on greenhouse gas emissions. Although Prime Minister Obama told Prime Minister Modi that he would try and help India in terms of alternative energies and solar plants and other renewables that could be considered. The third challenge is, can they really advance a rule-based order in the Indian Ocean area? Both United States and India are looking for a sphere of influence that extends from Western Pacific way into the Indian Ocean area. Can we ensure that kind of maritime security? Can we bring the United Nations Convention, Law of the Seas in that area are another question. And the last and the most important question that the United States in general thinks about is, will regime change lead to structural and institutional reforms? Well, Modi is representative of that regime change. But can Modi alone bring about that change that he has envisioned for India? There are two important points that I want to go ahead and make. From an international perspective, there are huge amounts of optimism, but there's also huge amount of pessimism. The question is, where is this relationship headed? Is it a transactional relationship, given the fact that India and the United States have not necessarily had any goodwill, any trust relationships? Or is it really the first step towards a strategic relationship where India and the United States could at some point come in together for an enduring partnership? Will India remain an ally? An ally, I think, in the eyes of the United States means a lot more than what India is willing to offer. It's not only about supporting the United States in international forums, but it is also fighting wars for the United States, taking position for the United States, and that's another area of concern that needs to be thought about. The same goes for this idea of strategic. So, I mean, the question is, will this partnership happen? Will the partnership continue? We should be optimistic, but we have to be realistic. It's a slow process. Partnerships don't happen overnight. But the Obama-Modi relationship and the second visit did reflect or symbolize that they wanted to have a partnership, at least in certain areas that were mutually beneficial to both of them. It's not that India and the United States will not differ. There are contentions on questions of international issues, whether it's Russia or Iran, but at the same time, the idea is that they are willing to talk and sort out those differences. On a domestic front, can Modi deliver? He has definitely a very, very ambitious agenda. All of the points that we talked about in terms of the reform are very credible, very necessary, but can he deliver? There are several reasons for that. The most important is the systemic and the structural constraints. That can a regime change lead to systemic and structural constraints? His intent is definitely there, but what he has to recognize is he just has a majority in the lower house. He does not have a majority in the upper house. So to get any ordinance translated into an act, he will definitely need the cooperation of the opposition parties in the upper house. Currently, he is requesting the upper house for passing the land acquisition ordinance, which would be the first step, an indication to the businesses across the world that India is ready to get businesses into India. Otherwise, a lot of times what we've seen is that it takes 5 years to acquire land to set up a business in India. But at this point of time, he is willing to go ahead. He might have to call a joint session of parliament and pass it by majority, but at this, he does not have a majority. The second important systemic constraint is also the Supreme Court and the public interest litigation process in India, whereby in the process of litigation, several projects get stalled for several years, and that's another area that he has to think about. He also has to think about dealing with the states. Will the states agree to his grand ambition and idea about development and growth in India? So there are certain areas which are systemic, structural, and Modi definitely has to fight for that. And the other important area is social harmony. Like I said, Modi is viewed with skepticism in the minority community, because of the communal riots. As Modi came into power, the RSS has been doing some vandalized acts of, you know, burning churches or doing those kind of vandalism. Modi has currently emancipated himself from the RSS ideology, which the RSS does not necessarily like. But if he is the prime minister, he has to ensure that he can bring about social harmony, because domestic stability is also equally important to economic growth and development that he's talking about. So in that sense, Modi does project himself as a causal agent, as a game changer, as a person really determined to go ahead with reforms. But whether he can deliver, I think it's a little too early to say. The intent is there, the effort is there, but the government has only been in office for 8 months, and he has a long way to go. Thank you.